Washington, D.C. is a city that lives on leaks. The political ecosystem very much includes the media, with policy often shaped or diverted through leaks to news outlets. And yet the place went nuts recently in several ways over the leak of a draft opinion indicating the Supreme Court was on track to overturn the right to abortion provided by the Roe versus Wade ruling. We take that up in our monthly media segment, Signals and Noise. We define media very broadly, taking in items about the media themselves and content delivered over a broad range of media, from social media to books. Our regular guests are here, Christopher Lucas in studio from the Communications Faculty at Southern Oregon University. Chris, welcome back.
Good morning, Jeffrey.
And on the phone, Victoria Sama, the journalism chair at Cal Poly Humboldt. Vicki, always good to have you back, too.
It's a pleasure to be here.
So let's start with the leak, because that was the place we got started. I mean, people got all up in arms about this leak, and yet there are consistent leaks from the other branches of government. Chris Lucas, why do you think this was such a big deal? I mean, aside from the content of the leak.
Yeah, I think it is hard to separate the content, you know, such a hot button social issue and, you know, an issue that we've really seen decades of energy building up around and maneuvering. I think there is also a fair bit of ginned up outrage, you know, that occasioned this, you know, once people started paying attention and realizing that, you know, this leak raised the issue. But really, in the weeks previous, there had clearly been some leaks coming out of the Supreme Court and some op-eds in the Washington Post that showed there were some information that might have been seen as foreshadowing. And then in the days after, you know, there's been more reporting that clearly shows that there are, you know, leaking is kind of part of the process, you know, in journalism, in Washington, in politics. And so we probably shouldn't be that surprised. I think that is to see a full opinion come out is certainly unusual. And then with the content being, so alarming to so many people and celebrated by so many people, that really led to this burst of very heated conversation.
Vicki Sama, where do you come down on a range that I'll provide some endpoints and you can extend them if you like, from you know, outrageous breach of trust to floating of a trial balloon?
Yeah, this breach really says a lot about the politicalization of the Supreme Court. And, you know, it's an institution that has traditionally operated in secrecy until it reveals its opinions in the summertime. And usually the process itself is done behind closed doors and everything is pretty quiet. The interesting part about this right now is no one really knows yet the source of the information of the leak, but there's a lot of speculation and guesses that it might have been someone who is a court clerk, given that there are just so few people who have access to the process of the Supreme Court's decisions. But each justice typically hires about 4 clerks each term, so that's about 36 when you have 9 justices, if you do the math. And so between those clerks and the personal assistants of the Supreme Court justices, you have just a handful of people who have access to the drafts or who are familiar with the court's processes. So there's a lot of focus on that as far as who might have possibly leaked the information. And, of course, that is a big issue of trust with the court, which has not necessarily seen, it's not as similar as other branches of government where we have seen a lot more leakage. For example, if we take a look back at the old case, the New York Times versus United States case where the Pentagon Papers mm-hmm. were leaked to the New York Times back in 1971, and the source of that leak was someone who was internal to the government. We've seen this happen in other branches, but not so much in the Supreme Court. So I think that's why there's such shockwaves about this. And how the Supreme Court is handling this right now is that Chief Justice John Roberts has said that he might initiate an investigation. But, you know, it's not clear that there's any law that's been broken because it's not these are not classified documents. These are just opinions that are drafts. And so it's hard to know what kind of legal action could be taken by something like that. I think they're more, shocked about the ethical dilemma they're facing in the court. And this is, again, just following another situation that we've had just recently with the court, with the information in March that Virginia Thomas, the wife of Justice Clarence Thomas, had sent text messages to the Trump White House regarding the January 6th attack. And Justice Thomas did not acknowledge that that was going on, and he did not recuse himself from a case where he voted on a case that was related. So, you know, that there's we've seen some sort of falling apart of the court in recent times.
Well, to continue down that avenue, though, Vicki, I mean, when you bring up the Ginni Thomas story, these revelations within the last few weeks, last month or two, about Ginni Thomas and her contacts specifically around January 6th of 2021, this is now May of 2022, and they're just coming to light now. I guess part of the thing that gets me about the leak ecosystem in Washington is it seems to be on a delay basis, particularly if somebody who is delivering the leaks to the public has a book in the offing, as Mark Esper, the former defense secretary, did when he did the range of talk shows over the weekend and into this week about the Donald Trump saying, can we shoot the protesters in the leg and that sort of thing. It's, you know, leaking seems to be done as it benefits somebody in some way, in this case financially probably, because then this person gets to make a big splash with a book.
And that's an important part for the journalist to consider as well, the motivation of such a leak, right? What is the purpose for that leak coming to them at a certain time? And that's one of the considerations. But another consideration is also verifying the information, making sure that it is, you know, legitimate before it gets out there. So that usually takes some time. That's why some things are not immediately released. In this case, the Supreme Court did confirm that the document that was released was authentic. And so that's part of the process on the journalism side.
Chris Lucas, I realize it's not so much an ecosystem as a leakosystem, and it's just a question of the timing of the releases of stuff.
Oh, sure. I think we have to remember, you know, any political system ultimately is going to have information as a commodity, right? It's sort of a source of power, and for reporters, they're often in this interesting position, right? They're serving the public interest. You hope in most cases, and they're getting information to the public. They're also making decisions, right, about the time to bring this forward, or when they've got enough sources. They're working with their editors to sort this out. I really think, I mean, this coming back to this story about Esper's book and the you know, these revelations about Donald Trump's comments. I sort of put my mind back in those days and realizing that there was so much information and news coming out about the statements of Trump. And some of it was, you know, it was very kind of out of bounds of ordinary political discourse and sort of attacking people and violence. And in some ways, I think like that bit of information might have kind of been a little less notable right in that moment.
It works better as a time release.
Yeah, perhaps so. Not to justify holding on to it, but just thinking about kind of how, you know, how far outside the bounds we were for a while there, and how reporters are negotiating the stories they tell and the stories their editors want them to tell.
Signals and noise here on the Jefferson Exchange with our regulars, Chris Lucas from the Communications Faculty at Southern Oregon University, Victoria Sama, the Journalism Chair at Cal Poly Humboldt. You can join in at 800-838-3760 on the phone, or send emails to jx@jeffnet.org. Let's move on to another topic, and this is about a high school yearbook in Longwood, Florida, which is north of Orlando. There was a two-page spread about events in March at the school, which included the documentation of a student walkout over Florida's Don't Say Gay bill, now put into law. And Vicki, you've been following this. Ultimately, they decided not to censor the yearbook, but place a sticker on it that indicated that the Don't Say Gay walkout was not a school-sponsored activity. Interesting set of events here and the sequence in which they came about.
Yeah, this was an extreme misuse of power by the Seminole County Public School Superintendent, who told the school principal of Lyman High School not to let the yearbook get out and be distributed, and then he wanted to put stickers all over the content on pages where students were shown at the walkout Don't Say Gay law. And on those pages, you see the students holding rainbow flags and signs that read "Love is love." And there's quotes in the yearbook from students on those pages who were at the protest. You know, they're expressing their shared experiences and saying how they feel accepted in the world and feel love for the gay community. It's an idea that apparently upset the superintendent, so he did not want that message to get out. You know, the students are experiencing these feelings, and the communities, you know, that are expressing hate or fear for someone who is gay. And so this walkout was a way for those students to support one another, and that's part of their school experience. So walking out of class and supporting the gay rights was an important part of their experience at the school. They wanted to express that idea in their yearbook, and the school did not want that in there. And so fortunately, the school board met this week and held a public hearing where they listened to a lot of the student editors, and they overruled the superintendent's decision. And what they decided instead was to have them add one sticker, which the school board actually offered to pay for, that would clarify that the information in the yearbook was not approved by the school, that it was not something that the school wanted. It wasn't a school-sponsored activity. So this says a lot about, the school administration power over the student press and over the student voice. And so that's really the second concern here, is definitely how school administrators are abusing their power. And a lot of that comes from confusion with court cases, and the courts have not been very clear about what schools should be doing. We've had a couple other examples, not just with Lyman High School, but last year at Bigelow High School in Arkansas. They ripped out pages of a yearbook because it had a timeline of current events that included the death of George Floyd. And in another Florida high school, West Broward High School, last year, administrators pulled the yearbook over a spread written by two students over their participation in the Black Lives Matter movement. So this is an alarming trend, and an alarming trend that goes side by side with around the country with legislators proposing bills that outlaw political speech, which has received the highest level of protection time and time again in Supreme Court cases.
Absolutely.
And yeah.
So yeah, it's interesting. And I was trying to figure out, Chris and I were talking just before we got on about how we'd even characterize what they were trying to do. Was, I mean, the sticker is essentially saying we don't support the. So this is a don't say gay. Ultimately, is what it comes down to, Chris Lucas. But a bigger issue for students just trying to talk about things that happened. This was the coverage of an event.
Yeah. I mean, it definitely was a surprising overreach by the superintendent, it seemed to me. The controlling law in this is Hazelwood, which is a Supreme Court decision from 1988, which actually did kind of work against press freedoms and freedom of speech for students in public schools. So they, you know, it gave administrations a lot of latitude to step in there. Since that case, which is now, you know, many decades old, that's been weakened somewhat. And a lot of this conversation has a lot of the law has circulated around this idea of, these students are citizens, and they are protected by First Amendment. And the question comes down to kind of what kind of forum are they speaking in, and if it's a forum, public forum, that is actually managed by the school has a certain amount of leeway there. But then if it's a more public forum, as Vicky says, where political speech is happening, then that should be protected. And this definitely seems like that kind of case. I just wanted to mention, you know, I was quite fascinated by the role of the school board in stepping in and trying to find a solution, which, depending on your take on it, may seem like, a cowardly move or appropriate compromise. But just underscores to me how school boards have become, in the current day, a kind of important arena for political discourse. And we're seeing a lot of the surprising number of issues that are of importance to the greater public emerge in our school districts.
I guess we shouldn't be surprised, should we, Vicky? I mean, the kinds of arguments that adults have about free speech are going to percolate down to that level.
That's right. This is definitely a free speech case, a First Amendment rights case for student journalists. And I do want to mention, it's really important to mention that there are solutions to this problem. There are New Voices legislation that are popping up around the country. These are grassroots movements of laws that are now in 15 states. The latest is New Jersey, which adopted the law in December. And these New Voices laws clarify and strengthen First Amendment rights for student journalists in public high schools and universities, and it protects the journalism students as well as the journalism advisors against retaliation for controversial content that they produce. And so it's a good solution to what we're seeing, and sort of a opposing factor from the other legislation that is being proposed on these restrictions on certain speech in our public schools.
Signals and Noise on the Jefferson Exchange. Victoria Sama is the Journalism and Mass Communication Chair at Cal Poly Humboldt. Chris Lucas on the Communications Faculty at Southern Oregon University. You can join in at 800-838-3760 and jx@jeffnet.org. Let's take just a couple of minutes talking about the update, because it seems like there's something new every time we talk about Elon Musk and Twitter. After last time we talked, it looked like he wasn't going to buy Twitter. Now he says, yes, indeed I am, and I'm going to end Donald Trump's ban, which Jack Dorsey, the founder of Twitter, also says is appropriate. Chris Lucas, go.
Wow, where to start? Yeah, this has been a lot of back and forth, and it's certainly not a done deal that Elon Musk ends up controlling Twitter. I think a lot of us who've been watching this unfold in the broader discourse around content moderation, pretty alarmed with what seems like pretty naive perspectives from Elon Musk about the nature of that problem. Recently, he described the banning of Donald Trump from Twitter as essentially a partisan decision, which it really was not, right? Twitter had really allowed Donald Trump to violate its policies on misinformation and kind of incitement for months, if not years. And really only stepped in after January 6th, and when he was repeating the false claims and protecting and supporting the insurrectionists. Then they stepped in, as did Facebook, as did YouTube, as did a lot of other groups. And so, it's a very complex issue, but content moderation is really, our research is showing that if these platforms do step in, they can not stop, but dampen down the circulation of misinformation. And Twitter's been on the forefront of attempting that and showing the way forward. So, I would like to see them continue their work.
Vicky, your thoughts on the Elon Musk and Twitter situation, and the responsibility, for that matter, of new media to regulate what's broadcast or put out through them?
Well, first of all, I think this is always a funny story. Every time I see Elon Musk, he looks like a cartoon character to me, and I just start laughing. On Tuesday he said he's going to restore former President Donald Trump's account on Twitter. He doesn't even own Twitter yet, technically. The deal, the $44 billion deal, hasn't yet gone through.
Right.
And he's already making decisions about what's going to happen, but that's okay. He's got a right to do that, and he's got a lot of money to put behind what he says. But, he backtracked after saying that. He said, well, yeah, I'm going to, there shouldn't be bans. No one should be banned. It may be bots, maybe scammers, but okay, everyone else should have the right to say what they want to say. I'm a proponent of free speech, he says. And then he says, well, of course, there are some things that should be restricted, some kinds of things that maybe are, quote, destructive to the world and or, quote, wrong and bad. So now he really sounds like he's just doing the same thing that Twitter's been doing all along, which is trying to restrict, speech that could be harmful to democracy or, is false, it's disinformation, it's propaganda. We see how well that's doing in Russia, and we know that it's a threat to democracy. And so Twitter's just, I guess, trying to do its part. And we've had a lot of discussion about this, on who is responsible for this kind of speech. Should we be making the government responsible? Should we be making private entities and platforms, the social media platforms like Twitter and Facebook, responsible? And that's been going back and forth, and there's still no solution, but the platforms have been trying to do their best. And now Musk comes in and says, well, I don't really want to have any of that. And that's only because they've also, reprimanded him a few times on what he's done, what he's tweeted. Mm-hmm. And so I don't know if this is really just revenge or this is just a game for him. And it's, of course, very entertaining to watch this whole process and to see what actually happens. And in the end, I believe that if he does eventually find the money to make the deal happen, he does become the CEO of Twitter, he does make it private, if he does all of these things that he's been saying that he's going to do, and by the way, Musk has said millions of times about things he's wanted to say, do, and doesn't follow through on them. We'll see what actually happens with Twitter and if there is any great change.
All right, about 45 seconds each for pick threes for the month. Chris Lucas, why don't you go first for your pick three choices of the media?
All right. I know I've promoted it before, but I don't want to, because of the news out of the Philippines this week, I want to encourage everybody to watch a film called 1,000 Cuts. It's free on YouTube, a documentary about politics in the Philippines, and particularly Maria Ressa, who's a crusading journalist there. A really amazing documentary called Wuhan, Wuhan, that's been at festivals and is now on Prime about the COVID lockdown in China. It's going to be free on PBS this summer as well. And then a very short bit of self-promotion. The students, for the first time in 3 years, are going to be doing, at SOU, are going to be doing their student film festival and celebrate the best in filmmaking over this last year. It's going to be in person for the first time in a while at the Varsity Theater in Ashland on June 1st in the evening.
June 1st. Okay, mark that down and then send us links and I can put these up on our webpage at jeffexchange.org. Vicki, your pick three for May.
Yeah, I think this is the first time this happened, that Chris and I actually have the same pick three. 1,000 Cuts was also on my list, so there you go. And my second one was a book I'm reading on high conflict by Amanda Ripley, trying to navigate the world of conflict, whether it's, so what she calls good or bad conflict. And the third one I will put out there is the Student Press Law Center. I want to put out the list of states that have these press freedom rights for high schools and colleges, mm-hmm. and so that students can learn about the source, I think, which is a great nonpartisan nonprofit organization that works to promote and support the First Amendment.
Okay, yeah, good to learn what your First Amendment rights and responsibilities are in school as well. So good on you for including the Student Press Law Center. Thanks to you both for another vibrant discussion about things going on in and on the media. That is Signals and Noise with Victoria Sama, the Journalism and Mass Communications Chair at Cal Poly Humboldt. Thanks, Vicki.
Great to be here.
And Chris Lucas, from the Communications Faculty at Southern Oregon University. Always good to have you, Chris.
Thank you, Jeffrey.